2 weeks, Border Boss and Friends becomes another podcast, like it's Halloween. Every 2 weeks, it's Halloween. All Holes Filled is when Mike and I explore the absences in our catalog of musical knowledge. We pick something general and something personal. And the personal is something that fits in, I view it as something that fits in one of our chosen life genres. You make a choice in this life. You ride for metal or you get the fuck off the bus. And sometimes new wave and sometimes soul and sometimes R&B. but, you know, the personal is kind of like something that sparks something in me. I wanted to listen to it kind of unbidden. And it's got to be, excuse my voice, it's got to be a seminal, influential, you know, something pivotal. It doesn't have to be the best. You know, one of the obstacles we've hit so far, Mike, you complained about this. One of the obstacles we hit is that when we finally drop our episode, people are like, oh, that's not the album you should listen to. You know what? Fuck you. part of the recipe here is curiosity. Like the album we chose is the one that we were kind of curious about, coupled with the fact that it's, you know, from an influential band and probably, you know, you could make the case at least that it's, you know, one of their, you know, Hallmark albums or something. So we pick something personal, which is something from one of our own genres, and something general, which could be anything. It could be anything from, you know, a wax cylinder of Thomas Edison to like a nanotech bug that you put in your ear that just wiggles your eardrum to a rhythm that is set by a teen somewhere in Yugoslavia. But we want it to always be something that you can at least put on paper as a, you know, a genre defining, a you know, a sound defining album. So we made some choices this week. I'm not entirely happy. Let's see if Mike's happy. Yeah. We're going to start with yours.
Yeah, so my general pick this week is Johnny Cash, American Recordings from 1994. Basically, the reason I chose this is Scott and I always ponder that how in the early to mid-2000s, did a bunch of hardcore people suddenly get into Johnny Cash overnight, mm-hmm. because it's a very weird genre choice to jump from... you know, bare bones hardcore to Johnny Cash. And it lines up with the Johnny Cash Nine Inch Nails Hurt cover. It kind of lines up with that yep. timeline, but it still doesn't really explain much. I mean, maybe those people heard Johnny Cash because of that cover and checked him out and liked the rest. I don't know. Of course I've heard Johnny Cash in the past. He's a man who literally has 100 albums. Like, you can't not hear Johnny Cash. This was his 81st album in 1994, so mm-hmm. that is quite a record. This is the only 81st album that will ever be reviewed on Border Boss. I'm pretty sure.
Unless we do like a Man as the Bastard album or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Or Spaz. Spaz had a bunch too. Yeah. But so this isn't the one with Hurt on it, though. This is the American Recordings 1994 is basically what is credited as re-jumpstarting Johnny Cash's career. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, he was big in the 50s or fucking whenever, I don't even know. Yeah. And I guess in the 70s and 80s, his record sales started to wane. And then he came out with this American Recordings, which was basically Rick Rubin from, you know, Beastie Boys and Def Jam fame, recording this album for him, and supposedly that was the key. That was the key that was holding Johnny Cash back for 20 years.
This guy had a 30-year fucking career of successes and was on the Mount Rushmore of country music, but he needed to still conquer the 90s as hard as he could.
So yeah, he hooked up with Rick Rubin, and somehow, some way, this was supposedly a big thing, but, you know, honestly, I didn't know Johnny Cash was a thing until that Hurt cover came out, so... Mm-hmm. That was a solid almost 20 years later after this, or I'm sorry, almost 10 years later after this. So, but apparently other people were listening to him at this point. I wasn't, but this supposedly kicked it off for him.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I listened to this because we listened to this, but I didn't know that was that big of a gap in this. I had no idea.
Yeah, I think that the Hurt was like 2000, it might have been like 2002. Yeah. But, you know, it was, I think this is American Recordings 1. I think that was on like part 4 or something. Mm-hmm. So. There was a few before that. So, you know, I knew what Johnny Cash sounded like from... But honestly, I've heard his old stuff. I've heard the Hurt cover. I used to have that Live in Folsom Prison LP because it was back when I was like a shitty record collector and just would buy anything interesting at the Goodwill. And now I'm a snobby record collector and I would have to wear white gloves just to pick through the Goodwill record because those are gross. Those are for gross people. But
well, the first time I met you, you were wearing the t-shirt of him flipping off the viewer.
Oh, yeah. That was one of my favorite t-shirts. But no. So, you know, like Scott just said, we kind of always wondered how that happened. And this record didn't really answer any questions for me. I guess it sort of did. So, again, I'm vaguely familiar with Johnny Cash. I think the appeal to this was it's incredibly stripped down. I mean, it's just a man and an acoustic guitar. And it even says in the Wikipedia it was recorded in his living room. And it sounds like that. It sounds like Johnny Cash is in your living room singing you these songs. So I guess I could see the appeal if you were already a previous fan of Johnny Cash. But as far as garnering new fans, I'm not quite sure because I'm not a big fan of singer-songwriter music.
Yeah.
And honestly, even as not of a fan, I think a lot of the music on the actual music, not the lyrics or the vocals, I think is inconsequential. There's probably like a technical term for it where you could replace any of the actual music on this with any other music and no one would notice. No, you could just be like, oh, this is I forgot the track names already, or Stella or whatever the first song is called. Delia's Gone. You could replace that with any other music in the world and you probably wouldn't notice. So that's why I've never really had an appeal to singer-songwriter music, because I feel like that about a lot of it, but especially with this, where you're relying on this man's vocals and lyrics, and, you know, he does have very good vocals. He has an amazing voice.
Yeah.
He's a guy who you would want to narrate your life, because he just has such a good voice. But, you know, and his vocals, his lyrics are dark, I would say, on this. And dark and kind of like a dark humorous sort of way. And I'm not sure if how long he was doing that shtick, if this started with this record or that was always kind of his deal. I was under the impression it was always kind of his deal once he became pretty famous. I never saw that Walk the Line movie either, so I don't even know like the basics about Johnny Cash and his past.
You mean Walk Hard?
Walk Hard. I've seen Walk Hard thousands of times. I've never seen Walk the Line, though. That is another thing I think that sparked the interest in Johnny Cash, is he had a convenient biopic about him. But you know, the only theory I can come up with after hearing this is that people, you know, I think if you listen to a very remedial type of music like hardcore for most of your life, and then you hear something with, you know, actual, I don't know if I want to say beautiful, but descriptive, very good, you know, lyrics, like potent lyrics, you're going to be drawn to it because you haven't heard anything like that before. And I don't think it's just singer-songwriter music or country music. I think it's like any genre. Like if you heard like really lyrical rap music, you'd be like, oh, you know, you can talk about more than stabbing somebody in the back or how straight edge you are. So I can see the appeal that way. And I guess the imagery is cool, although there's never a point in my life where I thought old men were cool. I still don't think that, and I am an old man now, and I still don't. I would never think I was cool.
I hope someone else thinks that we're cool.
Yeah, I hope so too, but all it takes is me flipping somebody off with a guitar in my hand, and all of a sudden I'm going to be cool somehow. But, you know, so I didn't outwardly like anything on this record. The only two tracks I could say that I sort of liked were the two that weren't recorded in his living room. They were recorded in the Viper Room in L.A., Whoa. And so they have a little more ambiance to them because there's people hooting and hollering in the background. Although that kind of soured me too, because once I found out they recorded in the Viper Room in L.A., I'm thinking these people are like ironically hooting and hollering at them, and they weren't fans of Johnny Cash. You know, they were probably just L.A. douchebags, and they were called in to be in the audience for this. And because like I said, it's kind of like dark humor, his lyrics. So I think they're just hooting and hollering because it's like funny stuff. I don't think they're actual fans of Johnny Cash. I could be wrong. I don't know what the hell is going on in 1994 in L.A., but that's what it sounded like to me, at least. And so that kind of sours it. The other interesting thing about this record that I, of course, never knew was that the track 13 was written by Glenn Danzig specifically for Johnny Cash.
I think I did actually, like in the back of my brain somewhere that existed.
It's not, I try to pay attention to that song more than the others, but honestly, I try to listen to this record four times and I just drift off because This is like sleepy time music, man. There's no.
Of course, it's called 13. Mike doesn't mean the number track 13. Yeah. It's called 13 because Danzig wrote it. So it's kind of a spooky number for the title.
That's the only indicator. I mean, I should have listened to it back more closely, but it didn't seem out of the ordinary for Johnny Cash lyricism, basically. So Danzig hit it out of the park. You know, and I honestly don't have much to say out of that. I don't like this. I hate singer-songwriter music. There's a few exceptions. Like I like Elliott Smith. I like an Elliott Smith record. Mm-hmm. I think some of the stuff he did is kind of good. There's no music for me to like on this. This is poetry. I hate poetry. This is poetry with barely music to it. Maybe write a fucking book if you're such a good lyricist. I don't know. It's not for me. I don't know what situation you would listen to this in outside of maybe going to bed. Like I can't imagine driving around in a car and just being like, fuck yeah, man, this is fucking hard. Cause it's not, it's, I don't know. It's very sleepy music. I do an Instagram called Retro Food Ghoul where I make videos of gross food. And I was like, let me put this on while I'm cooking, because then it's like, I'm kind of doing something where I have to pay attention and maybe it's good background music. It's not. I was just waiting for it to end so I could put something else on, cause it was depressing me. So in summary, I wouldn't like this when I was 16, or there's no age. I'm the oldest I will ever be right now until tomorrow. And I still don't like this. I guess if this is your shit, it seems to be pretty good for it, but it's not my shit and it's never going to be my shit. But Scott, what are your opinions on Johnny Cash?
I'm a little disorganized. I didn't take any notes today again because I'm in a death spiral.
I say it every episode. I'm never going to actually do it. I can't.
Yeah. I usually try to show up with some, like, because I have a tendency to ramble and I have a tendency to like lose my train of thought. So I try to show up with at least a little roadmap. Not today. I had some beers and I'm going to go for it. But, so first of all, I don't know if everybody knows this. I don't know if we have younger listeners who maybe don't know this, but there was a trend, and I don't even know how widespread this was. I think it was pretty widespread. There was a trend in the late 70s, early 80s of Urban Cowboy, Rhinestone Cowboy. Mike, did your family get into country music when you were very young?
Oh, God, Just for a little while? No, never.
Yeah, that happened like all around here. Like people who have no connection to the country or the South or anything were going to bars with mechanical bulls and wearing cowboy hats and belt buckles and like listening to pop country. And they stayed there. So a lot of my family in their recreational time listened to pop country. So I grew up with pop country as like part of my sound, like, you know, just the background soundtrack. Not everybody. There was a lot of like rock and like, you know, general sounds in the family beyond that. But a lot of my family were country people, like were into country music and consider themselves to be, you know, hicks or something like that. So there are some countries, there are some, you know, 70s pop country, some Dolly Parton, Oak Ridge Boys type stuff that is in the back of my brain in a positive way. Like, I don't hate it at all. I like it. And I'll listen to it on
purpose. Let's hear some examples.
Okay. So, there's a Conway Twitty song called It's Only Make Believe, which is basically like an Elvis pop song. That song rules. There's a Elvira by the Oak Ridge Boys, which is silly. So if you're a kid, that works.
Yeah.
You've probably heard it, but it's
I've heard that.
And like, you know, Dolly Parton's is a gift from the gods. She's like a wonderful singer. Is Jolene, any of her hits, they're really well done. They're perfectly executed.
I think Crystal Gayle gets a pass.
You know, if you ever encounter a video, everyone has seen this, but if you ever encounter the video of Jerry Reed playing guitar, the Eastbound and Down singer, the snowman from Smokey and the Bandit, he's a beyond capable musician. And very interesting to watch when he plays guitar and sings. So there's stuff like that in the back of my brain. I don't seek it out. I don't live there. But, it's happily ensconced. So when I hear something that is sort of like stripped down country sound, it doesn't bother me immediately. Like modern country, everyone knows how like modern country songs perfectly. They're like a Nickelback song where they perfectly map to a format and it sucks. That sucks. But if you listen to stuff from the 70s, 60s, you know, 80s, some of that stuff, I don't mind. And so that means that I don't automatically I don't say like, I like everything but rap and country. That doesn't exist. That like that format doesn't exist in my brain. I'll listen to this whether it's country or not. So I didn't immediately hate it. I kind of like music that's lonely and haunted. And this sort of has that sound. I really liked, you know, when True Detective came out and had that theme song. That shit was pretty cool. You know, like a spooky country song really can work. I like that. If there's a country song that's about some sort of occult thing happening and it's kind of spooky sounding. So let me tell you, I'm going to be honest with you several times this episode, starting now. But at one point I was like, you know, maybe I can find a slide guitar player and they'll humor me and humor the fact that I don't know anything about country. And I just want to play Ghost Riders in the Sky 7 times today. That's all I want to do. That's in me. So I didn't mind that. I listened to this and it's like, I'm never going to seek this out. I'm never going to play it again. I don't mind that I'm hearing it. And I kind of dig that some of these lyrics are pretty rebellious, that this dude's old as shit, that he's, you know, catering to hicks. Maybe not at this point. I don't know. But, you know, like his demographic are people who are, you know, supporting our troops and Blue Lives Matter. But he's singing them a song about how war sucks and how coming back from the war to like a shitty government that doesn't take care of you is garbage. That's cool. That's cool that you're giving that message to people who probably need to, for instance, hear that message. You know, stuff like that. That's pretty neat. Like that, you know, he was coming from a different point of view than any old man you've ever met in your life. You know what I mean? Like he was considerably aged by the time he did this stuff. And he was, you know, still having, if he was. So here's a detour. I don't know when a country song is original to save my life, because like jazz, country, any of those sort of ancient American art forms, it's normal and expected that you know the songbook, that you know the classics, and that, you know, your 30th album in your career could be an album of covers.
Yeah.
Like that's totally normal. And it doesn't broadcast to an outsider. There's no way that I would know from listening to this whether these are original songs or whether these are all like Great American Songbook songs or something like that. And I don't like that feeling. I don't like the feeling that I could be sinking my teeth into something that is just like the equivalent of head, shoulders, knees, and toes for a country musician. I don't love that feeling. I don't think so. This sounds pretty, you know, this sounded like sort of fairly modern lyricism, I would guess. But I almost wonder if there wasn't a really devious marketing thing going on. And, you know, that seems pretty obvious, I guess. But, you know, like the presentation of this was really cool. You know, the album cover, him standing there with that like super austere photography, Cash just written in a giant font. It's almost like you watch Mr. Robot or one of those shows now, like where typography is like a feature and it makes things really dramatic. And this kind of has that. And I wonder if somebody wasn't like, you know what, I'm going to make Johnny Cash go over this month.
I didn't look at this when I was reading the Wikipedia, but yeah, many of these songs were not written by Johnny Cash. Only five were. But yeah, they had Nick Lowe on here, Kris Kristofferson, Danzig, Leonard Cohen wrote one of these songs, Jimmy Driftwood, Tom Waits, and Loudon Wainwright.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool assortment of people. It's not like he's just covering, you know, Row, Row, Row Your Boat or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still like, I don't know if I love that half the album's covers. Or that
I don't know if it's covers, but you know, yeah, somebody else wrote the songs. These weren't his lyrics.
So I don't know if I really care about this. I don't know why this became necessarily a cornerstone or like a, you know, a launching pad for anything like that. It doesn't sound like it should have, even though whether it's good, whether it's valid, whether it's whatever, it's still pretty austere. It's still just a guy and his guitar singing, like, you know, singing fairly, you know, predictable country, you know, lonesome country songs. And honestly, like, I want this to be a little bit rougher. And he, you know, that's his style of singing, kind of rough, but he's an excellent singer and an excellent guitarist. So there's no rough edges to this whatsoever. He's like a perfect musician with, by this time, I don't know, 50 years of practice behind him. So he wasn't the guy to make something that had kind of a quaver to it, like a shimmer, you know, like, if you heard some sort of like really broken down old man doing something like this, and it was just like you just put a microphone in front of some like ruined guy on a subway and let him sing his heart out, you'd expect there to be some like, you know, some shaking to it. It doesn't happen because this guy is an excellent musician, like way, way overpowered for doing whatever he's doing here. So, you know, I don't know if it's really what I would have wanted out of this format of something like
that. Yeah.
Necessarily. So
I think it was probably just right place, right time. It was 1994.
Yeah.
You know, people were they're in, that was, you know, when different genres of music were blossoming. So I think people were okay with this shit back then.
Yeah, I mean, a random thing gets resurrected every so often. So when I was in college, Bob Marley all of a sudden showed up again.
Yeah.
And, you know, when this came out, Johnny Cash showed up again. And right now, you know, Smash Mouth showing up again. So it kind of makes sense. Like, you know, things move yeah. in waves. So my next one was, it was recommended to me. I'm pretty sure. So my friend Thomas, who's more into punk than I am. And he frequently tries to get me to listen to certain punk things, even though I'm an avowed hater of punk, but I'm softening. I'm legitimately softening on my old age. Like at some point in my 20s. So I'm going to be honest with you guys again, Mike, I'm going to be honest with you. When, you know, remember in, I don't know if it was 99 or 2000, someone in there when the Strokes came out and all of a sudden all kinds of other kind of like clangy guitar post rock kind of stuff started happening. Interpol, you know, stuff like that. I like that. I thought that was fine. I think that Strokes hit album, that's super listenable. It's like super fun music. And I loved Interpol. So, you know, it got me to soften up. And I already kind of liked, you know, I liked The Waitresses and Devo. So that sound was, you know, like the sound of that post-punk, whatever you call that stuff, that didn't bother me. And I really like eased up eventually on a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I got it. We did a cover album, a cover EP of Joy Division covers. So, you know, like I was ready for that. I was ready to listen to this stuff. But, you know, there was a time where this band that we know did a Wipers cover set.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, everyone was like, oh, the fucking Wipers. And everybody was into the Wipers. And then all I heard about for a few minutes was the Wipers. I was like, what the hell are you people talking about? None of you have ever said the word Wipers before today. And I believe them that they liked it because they knew the songs. But I'm like, well, why have you never spoken about the Wipers until you're 35 years old, and this is the first time I've ever heard you use the word Wipers in this. And all of a sudden, everyone in the world likes this band. So I check them out, and it's good. It's like, that's pretty cool music, you know. But I'd never heard them before. I've never listened to, you know, really the Buzzcocks, rest in peace, Buzzcocks dude who just died today. I never listened to, you know, Husker Du. I just don't, this range of music is not, it's foreign to me, but I'm dipping into it because I like some of it. I really like The Damned. You know, I really like some of this stuff. So he thought I would like this. And it's not far, but it's not really there because, so this is, sorry, did I even say the name of it? It's The Replacements. Yeah. I think I said the name. The Replacements, Sorry Ma, I Forgot to Take Out the Trash. And The Replacements are a band that's known for things other than this. This is not, someone's going to tell me this isn't their seminal album. Fine. I get it. Like, this isn't, Tim or whatever their big album was.
Yeah.
But this is part of their, you know, like this is part of their catalog that people respect. It's different from everything else they did. So I chose it. It's kind of, you know, it's straight punk with a little post-punk. It's straight punk, but one of the guys in the band is a good musician. So he made it a little bit more than that. And it's from 1981. It was released on Twin Tone Records. They were actually, you know, contemporaries of the band Husker Du. So it's kind of, you know, they're in that genre of like slightly above average punkers. And you know, the first song is pretty neat. It's got a bass sound that I really like. Like, it's like, I don't know how you would duplicate it without actually being in 1979 or something like that. It's got this really like flubby bass sound that I kind of dig. And it's got the sound I'm looking for. It's got the kind of, you know, angular sort of post-punk thing going on. The vocals are cool. Like, puberty is hitting this guy just right at this point. You know, sometimes puberty hits you and your voice does this, but sometimes you get that cool, scratchy punk voice. He's got the cool, scratchy punk voice. It's absolutely exactly right for an album like this. But then they, you know, they hit around, I don't know if it's track two or three, they hit track two or three and it becomes one of those jokey punk songs, almost like, you know, like Wiener Schnitzel by Descendants or like Bitchin' Camaro, where there's jokes in the song. And I noticed for the rest of the album, there are other jokes in the song that were recorded separately. Like, there's a little bit of chorus on the mic or something like that. I'm like, so you came back into the studio on a different day to make sure that your jokes got through the mix and were, you know, highlighted in this. And I don't respect that. I don't respect that at all. I hate humor. I hate joy. I hate anything pleasant. And when you do something like that, I expect this album, this album takes a different turn. And I think of it as being something from like Gleaming the Cube or like some, it's like the soundtrack to like a silly scene in an action in 80s, like, you know, kid action movie or something like that. And that belongs there and that's fine, but I'm not going to listen to it. I'm not going to sit down and listen to that music as music. So they lost me. Like, it just completely lost me after that. And I tried to find more in it, and I just didn't find it. You know, you listen to the stuff that I mentioned before. If you listen to the Wipers, if you listen to stuff that's way before Fugazi or anything like that, but it's still kind of odd like that. They use weird chords. They use weird notes. They hit, you know, some interesting ideas. This doesn't really do that. This is just kind of punk. And this band was known later for basically sounding like Tom Petty with punk parts. Did you listen to any of their other stuff?
No, I avoided it on purpose.
I took a little tour just through, you know, I kind of sort of knew it anyway, but it's like, I don't understand. There's a, I think, a direct correlation between people that like this and also like Social Distortion. I can't find the edge in this. I can't really find the thing that makes this like exciting or sticks out. And Social Distortion is the very, very bad version of this. Like, they're the most boring version. They're the most boring presentation of punk that I can actually think of. So did you listen to this whole album, Mike?
Yes, I did. And I guess before I start with my diatribe,
yeah,
there's two things. First, I'm pretty sure the Replacements are the band that years ago on an episode of Kissing Contest, somebody brought them up, and everybody in the entire Kissing Contest expanded universe knew every single Replacement song ever. And it was just like a band I had never heard of. I didn't. Yeah. I was like, I have no idea who you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I didn't know anything about this band, and it, you know, I kind of forgot about it after that episode until this episode came up. And the other thing,
I don't get it. Everybody turn to the person next to you and tap them on the shoulder and ask them if they like the Replacements, and they're going to show you a tattoo.
Yeah. And the other thing is this is what I always classified as best show music. If you guys aren't familiar, there's a radio show / podcast that's been out since basically I think it predates podcasts.
Yeah, but it's a radio show.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hosted by Tom Sharpling and his writing partner, John Worcester. And, they, you know, it's a radio show, so it's 90% talk, but they do play music, and it's 99% of the time it's music that's, you know, not mainstream, but it's stuff I have no fucking idea where it comes from. They name bands I've never heard anybody in my real life talking about. Yeah. And, you know, but it's underground though. It's not punk or hardcore, but it's some other thing. And, you know, every once in a while there'll be crossover, like when J Retard hit big, they talked about that a lot, and I like that album a lot. He's good friends with Ted Leo, who was in Citizen's Arrest, who later started Ted Leo and the Pharmacist. So that was kind of like a hardcore adjacent thing. But outside of that, it's always like run parallel to hardcore, this type of music. And I think it's just because it's like, at least for me, it sounds more suburban, I would say. Like, I think you could listen to this music because you know, you wanted to be a little edgy, but you still wanted to grow up and, you know, be like your dad and be a doctor or something. You didn't just want to be a weirdo who sniffed glue or anything like that. You just wanted like a little edge.
Yeah, you're not in immediate danger in life, but you want to be in the law.
Yeah, but, you know, overall, though, surprise, surprise, I actually really like this after I listened to it a few times. The first time, I got the same kind of vibe that Scott just said, where it's like, I listened to it and I was like, I can't, this music, it's so vanilla. Like, I don't know how the guys in the band could tell these songs apart, no less, you know, other people. But once I started listening to it more and I was like, oh, this is from 1981. That's really old for this type of music. And to me, it's not something, like, I definitely wouldn't have liked this when I was a teenager, but I'm thinking 1981, what else was around? Like, the Descendants, I think, were starting, you know, there was that type of like early punk, and it fits in that category, but it's not shitty. Like these guys, even though the music is vanilla, they're playing it very well. And it's, so I'm, you know, if it was 1981 and I had to choose between these guys and like DI or something, I would have probably chose these guys. I think these guys, you know, there's a lot of tracks on here that get too deep into the rock and roll, which I don't like, but the more punk songs on here are, I think they're really good. And I'm just like, I could see, if I was a teenager in 1981, this shit would like blow my mind.
It's excellently played. It's like really well executed.
Yeah. So I can understand, you know, picking these guys out of a group of I guess they're from Minnesota, so it's Husker Du. That's another band that we could probably do on another episode because I've never really listened to them.
Yeah.
And I think they had like a little rivalry going on. But yeah, all that music I just kind of never paid attention to. I will say, like, lyrically, it seems very empty, and I think maybe that was the hook where some people got into punk, because punk was, like, saying something, and it was aggressive, and this is kind of, like, I wouldn't say these lyrics are nonsense or anything, but outside of Johnny's Gonna Die, which seems to be about heroin, a lot of these songs just seem to be about a nonsense teen. Like, I'm a teen. I don't even know if he's a teen at the time. I'm just guessing, but I'm a teen and I don't have much life experience. And I'm going to sing, like, I'm going to listen to Rolling Stones and kind of copy those lyrics from a teen's perspective, basically. It's a lot of shit like that. But, you know, yeah, overall, I did enjoy this. And I, like I said, I purposely didn't listen to anything else because, like Scott said, I know this is not what they're famous for. And they're famous for, like, I would assume more of, like, an alt-rock sound. I don't even know, man. But
it's weird. It's it, like, I think that a key feature of this, which is something oddly doesn't impact my listening or my enjoyment of music, is that they're supposed to be really drunk when they do this.
Oh,
like, that's sort of the famous thing, is that they were, like, you know, I think that they were pretty notorious.
I thought that was the Pogues.
It's also the Pogues, but okay. This band, like the Replacements, is like, you know, if you listen to their other albums, it's exactly what I said. It's literally halfway between Tom Petty and, like, drunk punk. Ugh. And it sometimes one song is totally one way and sometimes one song is totally the other. So one song will actually sound like, you know, like the Gin Blossoms or something almost. And then the next song will be like, ah, bah, 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 bah. Like, it's just like, it's just drunk punk. And they were like crazy, you know, substance abusers of some sort. And that's the expectations, that you went to this show and just had crazy drunk fun. And okay. I'm not saying that that's bad. That's, if that's how you enjoy your music. It, like, I didn't drink when I was young, so I didn't have that experience. And that's not like, I don't really even register that as the possibility. Like, oh, this is so awesome. Like, we just got, you know, trashed and just had such an awesome time shouting along. That's not me. That's not my thing. And so if that's sort of the key of this band or whatever, is, you know, I want to occasionally, like, be crying while I'm drinking my beer because they're singing a sad song. And then I want to, like, you know, slam dance or something. That's the story, I guess. And I think, I don't know, one or more of them might even be dead from it. I'm not sure. I think they just, one of them at least became like a notable, you know, pop rock guy.
Yeah, Paul Westerberg. That's a name I hear a lot. I'm personally glad I listened to this. I'll probably at least revisit some of these songs again. I'm going to still purposely avoid the rest of their stuff. I'm just going to be ignorant about it. But
yeah,
I am glad this got exhumed from the list of All Holes Filled. Mm-hmm. And I got to hear it because I think it's pretty cool.
I was hoping it was going to be more secretly like Gang of Four or something, and it didn't really nail that. So if I re-listen, it might do it, but guess what?
Never going to,
It's not going to happen.
So this is my personal choice. It's not hardcore metal or rap or anything. It is Skinny Puppy, Too Dark Park. This record is from, is this from 19? No, it's 1990. Whew. I thought this was a little newer than 1990, but
yeah.
This is industrial music, if you guys are not familiar with the name Skinny Puppy. And this is not their first album. And I'm sure if there are actual Skinny Puffy fanatics out there that listen to this, they'll probably say this is not even their seminal album.
Yeah, this is definitely not their first seminal album. I think that they have like five seminal albums.
Yeah. So that's like the deal with Skinny Puppy, is that they've always, so I guess I should say the background why this is my personal record. When I started getting into hardcore and metal and stuff like that, it was my friend Jay, and he got into it from his older brother. And by older brother at the time, I mean like 18 years old. I don't even think he was 21 or anything yet. And by age 18, Jay's older brother, Doug, and all his friends were fucking over hardcore by then. Mm-hmm. At the ripe old age 18, they were over it. And
I wish I had done it that early.
Yeah, and so they're getting into like industrial and goth and stuff like that. And they all love Skinny Puppy. Jay even loves Skinny Puppy. Basically, I would say that most of the people in my life love Skinny Puppy at this point in my lifetime. They were a big band. And you know, I didn't know this at the time, but they're kind of the band that influenced bands that I would like in life, like Ministry and KMFDM and Nine Inch Nails. Like, if it wasn't for Skinny Puppy, I don't think any of these bands would be who they were. So they've always kind of been like the band's band, basically your favorite band's favorite band. And for whatever reason, even though I was into this music and liked it, anytime I would hear Skinny Puppy in Doug's car or somebody's house or something, it would just be really boring to me. And so I've held that in my head for up until this podcast, where it's just like Skinny Puppy is just really boring industrial music. But, you know, there's so many things about Skinny Puppy where I'm like, maybe I should revisit it because there's a guy, the singer's name is Ogre, and I always thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And if you saw photos of them back then, they'd always look real dirty, and they'd have like white man dreadlocks and just look like real filthy assholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I love their imagery, and all the people I knew wore skinny puppy shirts. I thought like the shirts were really cool. But anytime I heard the music back then, it was a snooze to me. So I took this opportunity to revisit it. And the reason I picked Too Dark Park was because I think that was kind of like the big one when I was the one people referenced. And that was the one that people wore t-shirts of and shit like that. So it's the one I associate with their seminal album. But like Scott said, this is like their third seminal album. I think they changed their sound like some, I think a little here. I don't know if it was... I can't remember if this is the one that's harder edged or softer edged or something like that, but it's something where it's a little different than their earlier stuff, which I think is the earlier stuff is what, you know, influenced all those bands like Ministry and stuff like that. But so listening to it now, you know, I can appreciate it a lot more than I did back then. I don't know if I could say I outright love it or anything like that. The one thing that I guess I wouldn't say it sticks out, but the one thing that you may have gotten away with in 1990 that you can't get away with now is these two men, both named Kevin, except one goes by Ogre. They're from Canada, but they sing in British accents.
Yeah.
I guess I never noticed that they sang in British accents. And I don't know if they both sing or it's just the one guy. I think it's just Ogre that sings, but I never noticed that. They're Canadian, but they have British accents for some reason. So that's weird. But outside of that, now that I'm away from this music, 20 years removed, or however it's 30 years, who even knows at this point, I'm so far removed. I don't hear other bands that sound, I don't hear any industrial bands anymore. I would have to voluntarily put in a record myself or go on Spotify myself and listen to industrial. I'm not around it. There's no peers in my life that listen to this stuff. So I'm not hearing 1,000 industrial bands like I used to. So now hearing it and being removed from that, I don't have anything to compare it to. It's pretty good. It's so weird that I thought this was boring. It's not, I mean, it's not as obvious as something like KMFDM or even Ministry or Nine Inch Nails.
It's not even metal. It's not even like industrial metal at all.
Yeah. But I definitely wasn't against any kind of like dance beats because I was coming from a rap background. But there was just something, I guess because it just wasn't obvious, it never stuck with me and it kind of just blended in. And I still will say that I listened to this record 4 times and I think the only song that I could, you know, if it started up, the only song that I could completely pick out right away is the Spasmolytic song, which is the third track, which is kind of has like what you would consider a chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is kind of just, you know, I don't want to say paint by numbers industrial because they invented it. So, right. So it's not paint by numbers to them, but it's, you know, a dance beat. There's a sample in the background. They're doing vocals like this. Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of just like, you could sort of dance to it, kind of doing that goth dance where you're just in a box kind of swaying back and forth, but real aggressive. It's that kind of music. It has that same drum machine that everybody on Earth used because that was the only drum machine you could buy back then. And, you know, like I said, looking back at it, I can enjoy it now because I don't have to hear other bands that do this. But yeah, it's not completely my shit still. I wish I had more to say about it, but I honestly don't. I'm glad I revisited it. I'm glad I could listen to it with clean ears, you would say, and appreciate it for what it is. I could see if they were the first to do it, that why it was so influential, because it is a good sound overall. You can definitely smoke cloves and dance to it at the same time. I will say it's not as interesting. What was the one you picked, the Horse Rotivator? Was that Wire?
Coil.
I don't think it was as musically interesting as that, and that's like a couple years earlier than this.
Yeah.
But I think it's because I grew up with this sound, so it's not as interesting because I know what it sounds like.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. I'm impartial to this, I guess. I don't mind it anymore, but I'm not going to buy a t-shirt or anything like that. It's fine. I get it.
You can now, though. You've listened to it, so now you...
Now I feel I can buy one of those cool t-shirts I'd see people wearing back then. But yeah, I don't know exactly why I didn't like this when I was 16 outside. I was too dumb to understand. But I wouldn't be shocked if this sound came back, this kind of retro industrial sound. I think it's 20 years removed. It's kind of sounds modern again. Maybe not the vocals, the like overemphasized croaky vocals. I don't know if that'll come back, but it has a sound that I can see somebody hitting big with in 2019, I guess I would say. But yeah, overall, whatever. I don't hate it. I don't love it. Yeah. Again, I think we've mentioned this on the show, but we're always talking about some special episodes, and maybe if we did the special revisit other seminal albums by the same band episode, I would pull another one of these out to see if I had any different reaction. But I'm glad I listened to it again, but it's nothing that's going to go in my permanent collection.
This is the funny thing is that several years ago, I started listening to a fairly, you know, old podcast. It's been around for a while. I think they were even something before they were a blog or something before they were a podcast. That's how old it is. Called We Have a Technical, because it's named after a Gary Numan thing. So oh. I like Gary Numan. And it's literally just two Canadian guys talking about goth and industrial music with crazy enthusiasm. And they've been at it for years, and they still have so much enthusiasm, and they're very serious about it, and they're very, you know, explanatory. So it's, you know, it got me to start listening. It got me to soft, because I was sort of into industrial music, but not really. You know, I like Ministry. I like Godflesh, and I tried to expand out from there. And, you know, if you know anything about industrial music, it kind of tapers off after that into things that don't sound like that, good or bad. It just doesn't sound like the things I was looking for. And, you know, so I listened to a lot of things here and there. Of course, I listened to some Skinny Puppy here and there, but, I didn't like it back then, but then I started listening to this podcast and it softened me up on a lot of it. And I really like, you know, now I'm purposely like sitting out here, like listening to some, like, you know, How Job and, High Functioning Flesh and all these bands. So, you know, ironically, this is the best time for me to revisit this. I'm primed for it, but also it's impossible for me to be an adult who gets into this in 2018. There's too much time between then and now. Like, this sound has become, like, when I listened to this, I thought of, you know, like Wipeout XL or like, yeah, you know, like 90s video game, 90s extreme futuristic racing games and stuff.
Yeah, even though it predates it, it was definitely the blueprint for the music like Dark City predicted we'd all be listening to in 2018.
Yeah. Yeah, this sounds like if a producer wanted to make extreme music exactly for a movie.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because if you listen to this album, it starts off kind of atonal. It sounds like quote unquote industrial music, like the sounds of industry, like clanking and harsh noise and samples being put over a dance beat while
he sings like this over it.
And as the album goes, it's almost like they recorded the album in real time as they learned how to write music, because each song gets a little bit more hooky and catchy. And by the last half of the album, they're back to music. They're playing, there's like chords, there's bass lines, there's grooves that weren't on the first half of the album. But that can't have happened because they'd been a band for 300 years by this time. They had like a long career before this, a successful long career. They had, you know, like you said, that they had other albums that were, you know, they had Vivisect 6, I think it's called. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Vivisect 6. Cleanse, Fold, and Manipulate. Those are like big albums. And I don't know if you listen to any of their old stuff, but their old stuff is beautiful synth pop. Like, their first couple albums are really great, listenable, I'm going to go back and listen to it synth pop. It's still got those vocals. So it's like synth pop over the top of it. But yeah, their old stuff is really like catchy, great, you know, atmospheric. It's very 80s and it's super awesome. And then they, you know, they got more industrials. They went along because they came from a new wave background, I guess, you know. So anyway, I didn't really sink my teeth into this because something's missing and I can't figure out what it is. You know, this is like, it's got the industrial sound that I kind of have softened on.
There's just nothing bombastic on it. It's just kind of, yeah.
It just there's a thing that industrial dudes, and I did this when I was young too, when me and my friend did some little industrial projects that you'll never find. You'll never find. Just don't open a tab. You're not going to find it. We really liked the idea of smearing the vocals with effects so they were almost just like part of the atmosphere. Now, when you do that, it's like, I don't have anything to latch onto. Like, if you just sound like a sample, if your vocals just sound like an atmospheric sample, I kind of don't give a shit. I don't really want to listen to what you're doing. What's worth checking out, if you have a computer handy, is look at them, because, you know, The singer is obvious. Ogre, the singer is obvious. He's like a handsome man who performed covered in blood. And Kevin, the other Kevin Key, I don't know how he pronounces it, looks like Axl Rose looks now. Like he's always worn a terrible hat on top of whatever he's doing with his hair and looked like shit. He's always looked really bad. And in newer pictures, he has really let himself go even worse. So you could tell who the singer is. Ogre got to be in everything. So the, you know, you mentioned Ministry and some of the other bands. The reason that some of the others, these other bands were influenced is that Ogre just joined them. He just joined Ministry and Revolting Cox and, you know, some of these other bands and put his unique vocals on top of a lot of that stuff. And, you know, that's like, it probably worked because the album that he helped Ministry with is my favorite Ministry album. Mine Is a Terrible Thing to Taste is an awesome album. I still stand by that. I still listen to that except for the oddly positioned rap song that's on it. Other than that, the killer album. So they had good ideas. They had good things going. This album doesn't really knock it out of the park for me because it's too soft. And I don't mean soft like wimpy. I mean like squishy. Like it just doesn't sound, there's nothing that really like sticks out. Like you said, there's no real high points. There's nothing really evil about it anymore. Given modern ears, there's nothing really heavy about it. It's like you had to be there. You had to know that this was odd because it was noisy and bizarre when no one else was really doing it. But you know what's weird about industrial music is that the further back you go, the more you find.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they were influenced by bands like, you know, like Portion Control and these other bands that were out back then. But if you look, you know, look up Cabaret Voltaire. Cabaret Voltaire sounded like this in the 70s. Like, 77, 78, they were already a band and they kind of had this kind of sound already. It was intact. They had those vocals. They had weird synthy like noise stuff going on. And then if you look beyond that, you'll find other stuff like all the way, I don't even know, like back to the 1400s, people were somehow making industrial music with croaky vocals. You just keep finding it. You can dig forever and you'll never find the first band that did this sound. I don't really get it. I don't mind it, but yeah, this album, like I'll bet if we, like you said, if we revisited and we picked, you know, one of these other earlier albums or something else, even just an Ogre album, cause I know a couple of Ogre albums and they are what I was expecting. So, you know, if you're bored, it's O-H-G-R, I think. It's not spelled like Ogre, like his actual solo albums. I'm not saying they're good or bad, but they were what I thought this was going to be, kind of more metallic and more like, you know, cinematic industrial metal. Do you think if you had actually taken the time when you were younger that this would have hit for you?
See, I don't know, man. I think I just had bad luck and I'd always walk in and a real boring song. Like I said, for some reason in my head, this sounded more stripped down to me. Like I think, I don't know, man. It's another band I haven't listened to in like 20 years, but I think like Chem Lab had like a more of a stripped down industrial sound. And I was just not into that type of kind of like minimalistic industrial music. And I always kind of lumped them into that. So maybe that was the synth pop stuff because I didn't know what synth pop was at the time. Maybe I was hearing that stuff and I didn't like that. I don't know.
Well, these vocals, when you're doing these vocals, you're doing a character. And I kind of don't love that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like a British character at that.
A British character. I mean, I listen to plenty of death metal and stuff where you're doing effective vocals. But I don't know if it's for some reason death metal sounds correct to me. It sounds like an expression of your throat, like you were bellowing. If you're doing a Barney Greenway thing, I could see some sort of a bear singing for your band and it sounded like that. This, there's no getting around the fact that he's doing like a character and a, you know, a bit, and it's, that kind of takes me out of it. It's that way for a lot of stuff. So we were just talking this week about the new Daughters.
Yeah.
And Daughters, of all things, Daughters is way like noisier and harsher and like more evil sounding than this is. And they're not even trying to be an industrial band. But, you know, when that guy sings, he's doing some kind of bit. I don't like it. Like I probably could have gotten into that album because it's weird and it's bizarre. And it's like, it's got like a sound that I don't think I've ever really heard before. But then that guy comes in and just starts like yelping over it. I'm like, what the fuck is this guy doing? Do something else. Yeah. Takes me out of the moment. So vocals are big for me. Like if vocals don't really hit it, I kind of tune out the whole thing. And that sort of, speaking of vocals making me tune out a whole thing. So my personal choice was Body Count. I think it's just called Body Count. The album's just called Body
Self-titled,
Count.
Self-titled, yes.
Self-titled Body Count.
1992
on Sire Records.
Sire, okay.
This is, you know, the band is Ice-T's passion. I don't know. I don't really know what the background is, but these are all his friends, right? Like, all like regular friends.
Supposedly they are people he went to high school with. Yeah. I honestly don't know if I believe that to this day, but supposedly, so that's the story.
Yeah, I mean, Ernie C., his Wikipedia says that he went to school with them, and it's kind of like, it looks fleshed out. It looks like at least those two guys, and you know, they both have a last name that's just a letter, so it kind of stands to reason they may have come from the same part of town.
And Ice-T was very old even when he was a rapper, so it is very possible he knew people who played, they were probably like a funk band in the 70s, or trying to be a funk band or something like that, and then Ice-T was like, hey, look, I'm famous now.
Yeah.
Why don't you start this bad metal band with me?
So this album took the world by storm. I don't know if it was a financial success or not, but it definitely was successful. And you're a rap fan. I wasn't at the time. Was Ice-T was known, but was he like a slam dunk? Was he successful before he did this? Like, was he a big...
So I was never... Ice-T is obviously West Coast. I was never super... I liked N.W.A. when they hit, but Ice-T predates N.W.A. So I like Colors, and even when he hit with the OG original Gangsta record, I was like, Ice-T, I was fucking 13 or 12 or something, and he couldn't trick me. I was like, Ice-T looks like an old man. He doesn't look like a young person that I want to emulate. So even right before this record, this Body Count record hit, I was like, Ice-T's kind of washed up at this point. And so, yeah, so I was familiar with Ice-T. I had the OG record. I had the record with Colors on and all that stuff. But he was definitely never my favorite.
His, like, the things that he was putting out that, you know, were making their way to my ears sounded a little contrived. Like, he was really trying to get white kids to be listening to, you know, his angry rants.
Yeah, he was one of the very few rappers, since I think he's one of the first West Coast rappers. He was one of the very few rappers to transition from, you know, the hip-hop, right, from that era to the new era, to the new 90s era. Like, there was not many that did that, so that's kind of why it probably seemed contrived, because he has been around rap music since day one.
He got to be in Breakin'. I didn't get to be in Breakin'.
Yeah.
So this album, this took the Lollapalooza crowd right along with it. It was like the right time for this to happen, for there to be, I don't know if there was a, you know, there was definitely rap metal and rap and metal crossovers and, you know, cartoonish, like Anthrax and you know, Run DMC and Aerosmith. There was, it had been some pretty over the top rap and metal crossovers, but this isn't really even that, because it's not really rap metal.
No,
I don't think this is Ice-T just shouting over a heavy rock band and something. So this is what this took me back to. My old brain is really failing me badly, because there was a genre of music around this time that sounded like this, that it's like proto groove metal. It was before groove metal. There was a lot of funk metal, and there was
like
Last Crack. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like the band Ignorance, Mind Funk, you know, there was these bands that, and there was and bigger bands. It was like Living Color and Fish. I'm going to name a bunch of black bands. That makes me sound really bad, but there's a reason for that. You know, there's some 24/7 Spies, Follow For Now. There were all these bands that came out around that time, or that like blossomed a little bit heavier around that time, that were doing heavy rock that had a groove to it. But they were using different kinds of chords. So when you hear a metal guy from this era, there was no groove and they were using power chords. When you heard like a Living Color song, they're playing basically like Jimi Hendrix and like Rolling Stones kind of chords, but through tons of distortion. So it sounds heavy. But it's over like regular rock beats, and there's something else going on. And it's not really new metal yet. It's not groove metal yet, but it's like sort of like laying out that path. This is like that. And it took me back. I was like, I had forgotten that that existed. I had just forgotten completely, not Living Color, but I'd forgotten that there was like a huge amount of bands that wore crazy colors. Like all white bands, black bands, everybody. They came out with long hair, short hair. They all wore like jam shorts, and they had like album covers that were all different, like psychedelic color schemes. They had stupid names. They had slap bassists. There was so much of this shit happening, and I'd completely forgotten that that genre existed. There was In Effect Records, everything other than Sick of It All, that's on that label. It's like Scatterbrain, you know, all these bands. They were heavy, but not scary and not evil sounding. And It was, you wouldn't call it cock rock. You wouldn't call it any, you wouldn't call it necessarily thrash metal, but it wasn't exactly in the mainstream either. So when I listened to this, it took me back and it was very like bittersweet or something. I was like, wow, I had forgotten about this. And even stuff that's big took its cues from that time. So if you listen, so my, pardon me for saying this, but my favorite Bad Brains album is Quickness. And I don't think that that's anybody else's favorite Bad Brains album. Sounds like this kind of like, listen, just go and listen to the actual song Quickness. It literally sounds like the song, Body Count, Body Counts in the House. Like it's the same riff as Body Counts in the House. And they sort of match. And at the time, Suicidal Tendencies, How Will I Laugh Tomorrow, had all these groovy parts, slow, heavy, groovy parts on it. And then they became a funk metal band after that. So it's no coincidence. Like things were going this way for other bands other than Body Count. So the fact that the band of Body Count were in that mix and were competent at it is weird. I don't know if you could pick that up, but, the band Body Count is really good. Like the actual guys playing this music are good at their instruments. It's a shame they're playing this music, you know, like it's really bizarre. It's odd that they sort of landed on this. I mean, I it makes sense because they're trying to find like a way for, you know, a way to mesh with Ice-T. But it's odd when you like when they take solos, they're shredding. When they're playing groove parts, they're nailing it. They're doing like the right things. They write a lot of really stock, boring, stupid metal riffs. And, you know, they're skits.
Back up for a second, though. I would like to know how you never heard this record. Were you just that racist that you just never listened to it?
Yeah. No, you know, like you could smell it. You could smell what was going on with this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think that I'm going to get into that when I get into my part. Yeah, you can definitely smell what's going on to it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so there's for you know, as Mike alluded to, as I'm open about. I don't know if I've discussed it on the Border Boss podcast, which is a PG, but when I was a teenager, I was legit racist. I was like, for real, like, you know, I definitely didn't, it didn't come up because I didn't have I went to a pretty white school, but I was definitely into hating rap and I was a fat Hessian and I was, you know, there was no real bad outcome for me to also be racist other than the fact that being a racist is its own bad outcome. So, yeah, I did. It wasn't into rap music. I didn't really like the kids that were like the white kids, the white hip hop aficionados in my school. I wasn't rolling with them. I'm over it now. If anybody's wondering, I'm a different person now. But when I was, you know, a 16-year-old fat, lonely, metalhead, I had no truck with this. So a few years later, I'm older than 16 by the time this came out, and Ice-T is forming a rock band and it's not particularly good. It's not like if he had come out and he had brought a grind band with him or something, I would have been like, holy shit, you know, but it kind of stands to reason that if Ice-T went on tour with a metal band that they'd be playing basically groove metal. Like, okay.
Like if Ice-T, if he fronted Suffocation at that point, because they had black dudes in the band. So you'd be like, this would have been awesome. Makes sense.
That would have been beyond awesome. I would have thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened. He could still do that, by the way. And you know, actually, you know, the albums, I don't know. I didn't listen too far, but the next album, whatever it's called, the one with the one with the actual BC like gang signs in the cover.
Yeah.
Is way heavier.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And what's funny is it opens with a skit where they kind of make fun of this album. Like where there's a critic, you know, giving him some shit about how boring this album is. And he's like, yeah, you know, we were learning how to play music. We're like, you know, we're a new band. We're just getting our, you know. He's like apologizing for how bland this album is. It's funny. What, you know, what's interesting is that when this album came out, it had a song called Cop Killer on it, which, you know, made waves. You can't do that. You can't be a black guy and put out an album called with a song called Cop Killer. You could be anybody else. You could be in a band called Millions of Dead Cops. If you're white, you know, but you couldn't put out you couldn't be a notorious, like, you know, rap artist and put out a metal album with a song called Cop Killer. They missed everything leading up to the song Cop Killer, though. You know what I mean? Every other song on this album is a little bit more offensive than that. You know, and it's all stock. It's like if you're making fun of metal, you do this. You make an album. If you're making fun of metal, if you're making a joke metal band, you write a song called Kill Your Mother. Guess what Ice-T did? He wrote a song called, you know, about killing your mother. He's ended up as an actor on Law & Order SVU, which is a show where they go after a lot of pedophiles and stuff. There's a song in here called Evil Dick, which is like him giggling about pedophilia, like in detail. The song, I'm pretty sure that the song is about a pedophile, and it's like, he's pulling his dick out, and it's like, wow, that's nasty. That's a very, that's not taking a good appraisal of the situation. That's not really like approaching. How did you get to be a cop after this? So I don't know. Like, I would say that this was both better and worse than I was expecting. Ice-T is obviously the weak part.
Yeah.
He is the weakest thing on the album. He doesn't really land any of, he doesn't really sing that hard. He doesn't really land anything. He wants to like talk between songs and make these points. But you know what? This also reminded me because they replaced the song Cop Killer with a song called Freedom of Speech.
Yeah.
And that also reminded me, I don't ever totally forget this, but I love little reminders of the fact that the PMRC was the most important thing in the world.
Yep.
To rock and metal dudes for a while. It's such a like a nothing thing now. You know, the music that's out now is so violent and disgusting and, you know, vulgar. And you can do anything in a song now. There's a band called... You know, there's a band with Converge dudes called All Pigs Must Die. The name of the band is All Pigs Must Die. They didn't hide a song at the end of the album. They named the band All Pigs Must Die, and they're getting away with it. You know, like that guy runs a studio. He has a day job. He has children, and it's not a big deal. But you know, that's like the tip of the iceberg with what you can get away with in terms of vulgarity right now. And the fact that we thought the PMRC was a crossover sensation, a genre spanning, like it was like basically the Crisis on Infinite Earths of music. Every band, every CD, every album that came out at that time in every genre was talking about the PMRC like it was life or death. Didn't turn out to be. It's a sticker on the album and you still got to buy it. Didn't really slow down anything. So what did you think of this album, Mike?
Okay, so I heard this album when it was still relevant. I didn't hear it when it came out. I think it was probably like a couple years later. And even by that time, and I was still very new to any kind of heavy music. I knew this was kind of a joke. I knew this was like Mucky Pup, basically. Wasn't like
that's serious another good one. Mucky Pup is another good point of departure.
Yeah. This was just like silly music. So, but I was like Scott said with the PMRC, the Cop Killer shit was on the news like every day. They were going over the Cop Killer trial. This is like the OJ shit, basically. this was on television. You were hearing about this in real time, and this is before the internet, so that's all you had to watch was this thing unraveling. And so by the time I heard Cop Killer like a couple years later, and I knew metal music better, and I knew this was kind of a joke, it was kind of a funny song where it's just like, I can't believe anybody would get in trouble for this because this is so silly. And even at that time, you know, a year and a half, 2 years into metal, I heard 9 million songs way worse than this song. It's almost silly how amateur this song is and how anybody would get upset over it. But it is because it's a bunch of black dudes singing it. And I, you know, as to this day, I wouldn't say to this day because it never crossed my mind back then, but listening to it now, this was put out by Sire Records, which was distributed by Warner Brothers, which was a huge major label back then.
Yeah.
It's not, I know people back then, people thought of the music industry like pro wrestling. They think all this stuff is real. They think these rappers are really going out and murdering cops and stuff like that. Right. All this shit. They think fucking Cannibal Corpse is really fucking exhuming dead corpses and fucking them. People don't know. You don't have the internet. You're not jaded yet. Kids really believe this shit. It's not like Body Count showed up to fucking the records, the record exec, the white man that owns their record label, and said, hey, we made this record. Can you distribute it to millions of places? And they said, yeah, we're not going to listen to this. We're just going to put it out.
That's
not
how it slipped through.
Yeah, that's not how this shit works. They knew damn right well what they were doing. And it's kind of fucked up that they, you know, they weren't to the PMRC. They weren't like, hey, fuck you. You know, so, but at the same time, I don't know if it might have just been on purpose, just for the publicity to get this new band started. Hey, this is very controversial. I don't know. It's kind of a shady thing. Because like I said, back then, it was easy to believe that Ice-T and Body Count just showed up to Walmart with all their records already pressed and all the lyrics, you know, just not approved by anybody. They just happened to do it and no one noticed. But that's not how life works.
Yeah, and the ordeal of getting a CD to a store 20 years ago is significant. It's part of the story. And it needs to be part of the story.
So, and outside of that, there's no way else to put it. This album fucking sucks. This is a new challenge for Border Boss All Holes Filled listeners. You find me a record that's on a major label that's as bad as this record. I don't think you could do it. I don't like a major label debut era appropriate as far as what was going on in music back then. I don't think you could find something that was put out by a major label as bad as this record. This is something that if you heard on a 7-inch by a local band, you would throw it out. It's so, I don't even, if you like, if this was an old school record, the 12-year-old fucking punk metal band, if you would be let down if this was music made by 12-year-olds. Not musically, like Scott said, they seem to be good at their instruments and have a knowledge of it, but it's like that Path of Resistance record where they seem to just show up over a weekend or something and jammed out and made a record out of that. There's more joke songs, and I don't mean joke as in like the Evil Dick song. I mean like songs where it just sounds like people dicking around on their instruments. Yeah. There's more of those than there are real songs. Like There Goes the Neighborhood is a real song, and at best it sounds like River Bottom Nightmare Band.
And there's a lot of River Bottom Nightmare Band riffs on this.
Yeah, so it's a lot of that, and it's fucking musically, lyrically, it is fucking atrocious. At the same time though, lyrically, Ice-T is saying a lot of things that weren't being said in metal at the time, not the Evil Dick stuff and the voodoo mama and that shit, but he's going over like trials and tribulations of being black in America, and even black dudes that were in metal bands were not singing about that stuff. So I do think this is an important record, but it would have been way more important if it didn't suck so much. Yeah. Like if this was actually competent and good metal, like if the second Body Count record came out first,
exactly,
you know, we might be on a different timeline right now. They might be regarded as like this huge important band, but as it stands, this album is really bad. I would hope no one genuinely liked this. Like I don't think you could have been into metal at the time and not as Scott put it, you couldn't sniff this out. Like you would know how bad this fucking was. So it sucks that it's that bad, because I do think it's an important record and it is worth talking about, but overall, it's just not good.
What I found interesting is that, like, I never listened to this album. I never even curiously, like, would stick it in the used bin or anything like that. I felt like it was a novelty album best left in the bin.
Yeah.
Until, like, they put out an album last year or something like that, and people were taking it seriously.
There's a bitch in the pit.
So that's kind of why I bumped up that, and also my guitarist in my band swore by some of this. He likes... He likes Violent Demise. I think that's the third album. That's the one I was talking about. And it's heavy. That album's, I don't know if it's better. I'll say it's better because they like kind of like deliver it harder. Ice-T shouts like an actual hardcore singer almost. The guitars are heavier. It's a better produced album. There's a whole guest band on the first track called like Raw something. Raw. I forget what their name is. I think they're rappers, but they do a really good job of shouting. It sounds like hardcore or something like that. It's pretty decent. What I was surprised by is how much of this album I knew anyway. It's basically a pop song on it called The Winner Loses.
Yeah.
Wanna get high as the sky. Like,
yeah,
I knew every line of it. He got to the part where he says like, next thing you knew, cardiac arrest. I was like, I knew it was coming. I was like, what the fuck? Why do I know this song? It's like, it's not really that bad a song. It actually sounds, you know, like a, I don't know. Sounds almost like a Sugar Ray song.
Like one thing I did want to point out, though, this is fucking, we listen to this on Spotify.
Yeah.
Any record, that fucking Replacements record that we listen to has two different versions. Mm-hmm. One, the normal version, and then one that has like 31 tracks, so like fucking off for 20 tracks. I don't even know what the hell's on that shit.
Yeah.
Every single seminal record we've listened to this on the show has a couple versions on it with remasters and all that shit. And the Spotify version of Body Count doesn't even have fucking Cop Killer on it.
Right.
Like 20 years later, it still doesn't have that song on it. And that is just cowardly by whoever is responsible for this. I thought they just started, after the controversy died down, I thought they just started putting it back on the album. I didn't know that it just stayed off the album forever.
I don't know. And that song is, I went and dug it up from, you have to go to YouTube if you want to hear Cop Killer. You can't hear it on Spotify. I dug it up and I was like, in my mind's eye, that song was really hard. Like, Cop Killer, you know, I thought it was going to be like just the peeling the paint off the walls with the, you know, cop with pig icing fury or whatever, but it's not that heavy, it's not that hard, it's not that exciting of a song. The lyrics aren't that, they're sort of there, but it's like I you know, I'm not gonna blame him at all for this, because you gotta, like, you know, take your shot or whatever, but the lyrics kind of split the difference. They're like, the cops will pull you over because you got long hair. No, like you're allowed to say what's true, what's, and he does, he kind of digs into it later in the song, but it's like he wanted to include the metalheads because he knew the audience or whatever, but it's sort of like he has to do that, and then it has to become a fantasy about hunting cops in the night or whatever, like some sort of thrash metal wish fulfillment thing or something like that. And it's like, there's probably a better song in there. Like, if he had actually made a song called Cop Killer and dug into what is true about that situation, that could have, like, been a blistering thing. You know, that could have been a pretty some sick shit. It kind of, because, like, if you actually listen to it, it's really just like, I'm going out in the night and I'm going to hunt cops down. It's like, is anyone really doing that? It's not the thing you probably think it is if all you remember is MTV Music News talking about, you know, Ice-T, like,
yeah,
you know, fucking things up with his Cop Killer song. And like I said, there's worse stuff on the album. Like, just on spec, there's other things in the album that are a little bit worse than that. I will say that there's at least three songs in the album with Body Count in the title.
Yep.
Love that. I fucking love that. And it ends with a song called Body Count Anthem. That song, it's dumb, but it's one of the best songs. It's one of the best songs in the album. They pick some notes that are a little off. They don't play the River Bomb Nightmare band riff. And the whole band is shouting along. They're having a great time. I love it. They really get me there. So, you know, I'm not going to listen to this again. I'm going to dig into some of the other stuff just out of respect to my guitarist, who is a listener. And because he was right that the other album is definitely heavier and more exciting. And
the institutionalized cover from the one a couple years ago.
A1. I'm probably not coming back to this in any capacity other than that, though.
No.
And the cover, boy.
I think it was a little more acceptable back then. 1992, it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I know what they're going for. And, you know, I love abs and pecs as much as the next guy.